This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency for information for IT professionals. For more information, advertising opportunities, and to download other shows, visit ciaops.podbean.com. This is episode 31 with Michael Jenkin and is brought to you by the Computer Information Agency. Visit us on the web at www.ciaops.com. Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and in this episode, I'm joined by Michael Jenkin. Michael, how are you going?
Hi, Robert. How are you today?
Good, thank you very much. And as we always start off on the Need to Know podcast, what we'll do is we'll get Michael to introduce himself to our listeners. So, Michael, just give us a bit of background on who you are and what you do and where you've come from.
Well, I guess where I come from, it probably explains more about who I am. I cut my teeth in IT back in 1989-91 on an old GEM BASIC machine, an XT machine. And from there, I started to experiment and play with all sorts of homemade computers and bits and pieces on breadboards. And then I decided to get a job working in retail at a computer store, went to a computer technician, managed the store, went into wholesale, went into programming, and then finally landed on my feet doing what I love, which is computer engineering. I've been doing it for many years now and learned many things along the way. Been lucky enough to learn my trade as it expanded and grew, unlike young fellows out there today who have to learn a whole lot real quick. So what I am today, I guess, is an amalgamation of 20 years of IT learning and a real love for IT.
So you're not saying you're an old man?
I'm not an old man yet. Having said that, I have had to get glasses recently, have my hearing tested, and my hair's going grey. But what defines old?
No, I think that all comes from the job, doesn't it? It's not to do with age, surely.
Oh, look, I think the job definitely has a big influence on that, especially the older you get, the more you tend to sit behind the computer and ask others to do things for you, and you do tend to get a bit sedentary, not do much.
Well, like I said, I suppose what we're seeing now is a bit of a maturity, I suppose is the nice word to say, in the IT industry. It was all, you know, when we were young whippersnappers, and it was all building our own boxes and putting on DOS and, you know, doing all these batch commands, and now it's all being streamed to us, you know, across the internet and the move to the cloud. So, again, it's sort of interesting to have gone through the whole cycle with the with a product or a vertical, and again it gives you a different perspective now that it's far more mature, and in some ways it's perhaps changing in a direction that you might not agree with or might not be as involved with. So again, it's very interesting to see how radically it changes, and I think at the end of the day, if one thing categorizes the industry, it certainly is rapid change. I mean, is that sort of your overall impression of the industry? Would you be telling people?
Absolutely. I think anybody that tries to get into the industry today has a very, very small time frame to learn a lot of information, unlike ourselves that have been doing it for a number of years, where everything new that comes out just layers upon previously learned knowledge. People out there today have to learn everything really quickly to come up to speed, or else they're not of any use in the marketplace. We got to see the old hardware swapped out for the faster and the newer hardware, and as the newer hardware came along, more resources, so therefore Windows got developed, other programs got developed, and then on came the internet. The guys today, they have to learn everything about basically everything IT, which includes going back to school to learn about interrupts, learning about DMAs and things like that when they have hardware faults, understanding how all that stuff worked, and yet today they're blessed with plug-and-play technology. So today, it's such a rapid learning pace. I really fear for the younger generation trying to cram all this stuff in to keep up with us guys that have been doing it for many, many, many years.
Well, I think, again, the interesting thing is obviously that, you know, experience is definitely something that people underplay. And unfortunately, in our industry, it changes so dramatically that, we do need to relearn it. But I think the basics are obviously there, and they certainly do help. And again, it's something that you can pass on to others and allow them to shortcut their learning to an extent. And that's what we obviously want to cover. What I've asked Michael to come on the podcast for today is just to share his experience with the whole idea of community, volunteering, and mentoring others. So What we might do, Michael, is just start off is one of the recognitions that I know that you achieved during your career is what's known as a Microsoft MVP or Most Valuable Professional. We've had a number of those people also on the podcast, but it might be a good idea just to slow down and let people who are listening know exactly what an MVP is and, you know, what it involves and how you do get recognized for that award. So can you give us a bit of background on that award, Michael?
Certainly. Look, the MVP program came about many, many years ago, and it was an internal, I guess, promotion program from Microsoft staff who had worked with somebody who didn't work with Microsoft and thought that this person had technical knowledge that needed to be shared and they needed recognition, and then they would nominate that person to get this award and be highlighted in the front of the public and pushed out there and said, hey, look, this person knows what they're talking about. Because the MVP program represents technical people that know what they're talking about, have done the hard yards, and are willing to share. The whole MVP program is a nomination system into a wider group of people, knowledgeable people, who are out there pumping the streets, in the emails, in the forums, and answering people's questions. The person who's an MVP traditionally is answering thousands of emails per week, answering thousands of forum posts per week. They're going out in the community, they're involved in community events, they're representing Microsoft for presentations around the globe, they're getting involved in online events, solving issues, and what do they get paid for it? Nothing. Their pay is you guys out there listening who are actually learning from what the MVPs know. MVPs tend to be called brain boxers, they get to be called all kinds of things that sort of indicates that they know a lot. There is a bit of a curse with that. I don't know any MVP who doesn't think about it at the end of the night. I know so much information, wouldn't it be a shame if I can't pass that on? MVPs spend their time trying to get what's in their head out into emails, out into the forums. You can use it as a resource later to do a bit of data mining to solve your problem. So many times you'll have gone to Google or to the Microsoft TechNet forums or somewhere, typed in, I'm having this problem. It might be, I don't know, with SharePoint, it might be with Word, it might be with Excel, and a reply comes from an MVP. That person feels they're knowledgeable, that person feels that they know a solution to your problem, they're not expecting anything back from you except a simple thanks. MVPs don't work for Microsoft, however, they get a channel into Microsoft. If you ask an MVP a problem that they know can't solve it, they probably know someone who can escalate it internally and get a solution to you. Some of the great knowledge base articles that are on TechNet came through MVPs. A lot of the great solutions out there, some of the hot fixes that came around came through MVPs. One of the best ones I can think of is when 2003 SPS was released, there's a problem in SharePoint where it actually expired on October, I can't remember the exact date now. And one of the MVPs came up with a script to fix it. This MVP didn't want anything, didn't even really want thanks. He just wanted to be able to put servers out there, have no problems with them, and share the solution with lots of other people. Some of the great benefits MVPs get are the ability to actually go to conferences in Redmond, meet the product teams, and actually make changes in the products. So one of the great experiences I've had is when I was working with the small business user groups around Australia, is I would hear feedback about, why has Microsoft put that box over there? Why is this OK button here? Doesn't it make more sense to be the other way around? Sitting in front of the people who develop the code, who test the code, who make the code and ship the code, they suddenly all said, why didn't we see that before? Why don't we make that change? And then the final product went out, community input made it into the final product. So the MVP system is a fantastic way to highlight somebody as being a technical expert, but it's also to give everyone out there access to higher technical skills with people who are community-minded and want to help and want to affect change, and they want to help the product be better for all the people out there.
I think, like I said, I think that what people need to understand and appreciate is like I said, that firstly, MVPs are not paid by Microsoft. They're obviously, it's a recognition for the work they've done for the community around promoting Microsoft products and enhancing the knowledge and understanding of that. But as you say, I think an important part of it is the conduit back into Microsoft. So, you know, MVPs typically have a focus on a product, and that's what they're awarded their status in. They know that product very well. But again, again, they don't know everything. There are people out there who, have questions or have done things a bit differently. And I think, again, the big benefit that you've highlighted there is that, you know, contacting an MVP or working with them, or, again, they're the interface that actually understand the community side of it, the customer side of it, and you can go with a problem and say, look, how do we solve this? And the MVP, like I said, typically may not be able to resolve it for you, but they will either know other MVPs who may be more experienced, or, like you said, take it back to the actual product team and escalate it up and get a resolution. So I think it is a very good program, and it's a program that everybody can take advantage of. I think that, again, that it's a matter of, you know, making the system, to your benefit, and people shouldn't see it just as, I don't think, as an elite program that rewards a select few. I think, again, it recognises these people as leaders in their community and, you know, again, makes them available to the day-to-day IT resellers and customers to get better support. So, again, I think it's a very important program, and I think it has, you know, major benefits. And I think, unfortunately, in some cases, people may see it as a program that they can't get involved with. But the encouragement is that, yeah, look, you know, contact these sort of people. And it's amazing, you know, the lengths that some MVPs will go to, the assistance they'll provide, and, you know, the help they'll give you above and beyond, their normal day job. So I think that's fantastic. And obviously, Michael, you've experienced that and given back to the community in that respect. And I think that's what I'd be encouraging people. I mean, is that a fair comment?
That's a very fair comment. Look, the MVP program includes resellers, wholesalers, it includes people of all walks of life. I know many MVPs who run their own very small business, themselves and their wife. They spend the whole day trying to make an income, and then when they get home, they spend the whole evening answering questions in the forums. These people are not fantastic at anything in particular except being community-minded and sharing what they know. What I'm trying to say is anybody could be an MVP. They could be the shy person in the corner that just happens to know a lot and their personality is really through the keyboard online, or it could be the outspoken person on stage who's doing a presentation who part-time actually contracts to Microsoft. It could be anybody. The opportunity to become an MVP, really it's about getting out there, being in the community, helping others to understand things that you've solved in the past, getting out there, making links, making connections, networking. Basically, it's a real community focus. Anybody can be an MVP. If anybody out there has the technical skill, has the will to share, has the will to get out the community and be very active in that community, Microsoft will see you and then Microsoft will put you forward to nominate you for an MVP. With the MVP program, there are other programs. There are also MVP affiliates and people that are on the way to being an MVP who have been recognized. And for that, they get a little bit of a pat on the shoulder from Microsoft. There are other community groups out there. And Microsoft do have those groups as their main community focus. They've got enough employees looking at technical focus. They've got enough employees that are paid to be on TechNet. They've got enough employees in the corporate system. They need people outside of the corporate system who are community focused, who, whilst they work with Microsoft products, are not necessarily loyal to Microsoft. These are outspoken people who work with many technologies, who work with all kinds of things that have to talk together, not necessarily all Microsoft centric. That makes them someone you can listen to and trust, because the MVPs are not necessarily tied to Microsoft and having to use only Microsoft products. So I guess really, yep.
Now, I was just going to say that, for example, you know, the MVP program, like you recognise, is not the only one. It's one there that, like, I think Autotask has what they call rock stars, you know, an Autotask rock star. So, again, it's a program, I think, that Microsoft pioneered but is now being taken up by a lot of vendors because they recognise the fact is, you know, you've got specialists who are using this product day in and day out and may know a lot more about the product because they're actually using it rather than developing it. So, again, it's what we're talking about in MVP stuff here is generic to a lot of other vendors. So, again, it doesn't mean that people out there can't get involved in whatever product, you know, that they're most passionate about. Again, there is this opportunity to get involved, to help other people. And I think the theme that we're trying to bring across, and Michael's the right person to be talking to, is about this concept of, you know, the community giving back, volunteering. I think that a lot of people look at it and, oh, look, I'm so busy running my business and have you got time to answer thousands of emails and why should I do all this? But I think what we're trying to convey here is that not only does it you know provide a better world for us, but it also can give some business benefits as well. So I think one of the other you know good examples that Michael's told me about is when he got involved with doing some work for the Scout Jamboree. I mean, can you give us a bit of background or what was involved in that sort of effort there, Michael?
Sure. Look, the Scout Jamboree was held in 2004. This is the National Jamboree for Australia. It had international visitors as well. It was held in South Australia in my own little hometown. And I had the ability to get in there and help out with this project. Now, I'm not a Scout. I've never been a Scout. I've never been a Scout leader. And I'm in no way connected with the Scouts, except that every year I aim to get out there and help them with their JOTA, which is Jamboree on the Air, which is pretty much hooking radios up and talking across the planet. There's also hooking in packet radios and talking through the network systems and over the internet and things like that. Year upon year upon year, new technologies have come out and things have gotten fancier and fancier and fancier to the point where I've actually got 60 laptops in my shed that are all ready to go. I've got a proxy server in my shed. They call on me, I roll it out, I hook it up, and I get them all chatting together on the internet with people around the globe. Then someone basically within the scouting organisation said, hey, look, this guy, Michael Jenkin, he's pretty active in the community. He's out there and got a pre-built kit. How about we get him involved with this Australian Jamboree? I had no idea what I was in for. There was 11,000 scouts who signed up for the event. On one day during the 11-day event, there were 20,000 people on site. We had 65 hectares, which we had to turn into a city. Now, this 65 hectares... had everything from creeks running through it, uneven ground, it was a bushfire zone, there were snakes on site, there's no power, no telephony, no nothing. We had to start from the ground up, we had to put in roads, we had to put in things like poles to run our aerial bundle conductor data cabling. We had to also put in all the phone systems. We had to use Cisco products to put in long-range Ethernet to get the data across the site. We had to put in the servers, and we had to work out emergency systems. For that period of time, that site had its own police force, its own fire, medical, surgery. It had its own post office. We had our own postcode for those 11 days. Now, this was a lot of work, a lot of computers to set up, a lot of administration to set up, a lot of databases to set up, had to link a lot of things into Medicare, had to link into the police, had to hook into the emergency radio network. There was a lot of work involved. It was a fantastic challenge, and it took 3 years to build this. When we actually had this event, there was nothing better than sitting back and being told that the IT is running so smoothly, how would I like to join the security team? Something I'd never done before. So I put on my fluoro jacket, I grabbed my walkie-talkie radio, I grabbed all the security things I needed. Next minute, I'm escorting Guy Sebastian to the stage. Now, that was pretty cool because my wife was a Guy Sebastian fan. And then Jennifer Hawkins, who won, I think it was Miss World.
Universe.
That's right. She stepped on the stage and I got to help her up onto the stage. And I thought, this is just getting too cool. Then I met Sophie Monks. Then I met a few other people as well. I think it was Joe Bailey from Big Brother and the Governor General. So all my IT volunteering and community work led me down this whole other path where I was on site and met these other people. And I also got to see the IT in use by all these people, which is really exciting. At the end of the 11 days, that was probably the most disheartening. We had to pull it all back down to bushland again. One of the big mantras of the Scouts is to leave no footprint behind. So we had to pull down all of the aerial bundle conductor and all of the phone systems and all of the computer systems and dig everything back out of the ground and return it all back to 65 hectares of paddocks with kangaroos. So the whole thing was returned back to how it was. But the experience was just absolutely amazing. I learned so much through volunteering. I learned so much about stuff that I was not actually intending to learn. I learned about emergency systems, I learned about phone systems, I learned to work a lot with internet providers. Just amassing that much technology in one spot, right down to cable tying, things like wireless access points to the sides of trees and hooking up long-range Ethernet connections to run 8 kilometres in one direction and 2 in the other. Things that I never thought I would learn. And all of that was because I was prepared to volunteer, jump into the community and give it a go.
So, sorry, I was going to say is in that case, you know, the two questions I've got for you is you know, what prompted you to get involved initially? What spurred the interaction? And the second thing was is that I assume you were doing this as part of a team. It wasn't obviously just you or you and employees. You were doing this with other people who had volunteered their services as well.
Yeah, look, I was the IT manager. Therefore, it was my job to source staff. My father is ex-Telstra, so he was the first person I asked to help me out with the telephony side. I ended up with a team of about 18 people, and between us we had 3 or 4 emergency golf carts, and we used those to get around the site. Where they're all volunteers, some of them were retired and looking for something to do, and some of them were still working like myself, and just wanted to give back to the community and be involved in something bigger than themselves. As far as getting involved in it and what spurred me to get involved in it, it was a bit of a challenge. It was something outside of my comfort zone. It was giving back a bit to the community. It was really about me hearing that something was out there, that they needed someone to fill the role, but they hadn't found somebody just yet, and I could possibly do it, and I just had a challenge, and I had to go for it. The benefits from that were fantastic.
So yeah, that's what I was going to say, is obviously you got a sense of fulfillment, you got a job well done and working with a handpicked team, pulling that together and then obviously, you know, making it all work so successfully and then, you know, leaving no footprint, as you said. But obviously by the sound of it, the benefits or the, you know, the relationships didn't end after that event.
Absolutely not, no. We had some fantastic sponsors from Microsoft, from Dell, from APC, from a large number of vendors, including HP. We got a $38,000 server delivered to us by Dell, which had the latest technology in it I'd never seen before. We had $1 million worth of routers and equipment given to us by Cisco. We had all this stuff laying on our doorstep to play with and to work with. And then afterwards, I've still got the Cisco person's contact details. I've still got the APC contact details, plus the team members themselves have gone off and done other smaller projects around the place, and I've been involved in the planning of those projects. So the team we had still exists, except that the team members now run their own teams, and now collectively we're a much bigger group with our own individual projects going on. But the benefits have also included things like I've learnt so much through it about interaction with big projects. I've learned a lot more about various areas of IT I've never dealt with before. I also learned how to deal with that many people all at once. It's just a complete experience. I've never, ever, ever been in a place that turned over 220,000 eggs per day. I've never been in a place where semi-trailers of toilet paper have to arrive per day. I've never been in a place where there's complaints in the local newspapers because there's no buses left, because all the buses have gone up to this event and no one can get a flight in and out of South Australia because there's just people coming from everywhere and all the planes that are landing are full of scouts. The event was such a huge thing to learn so much about interacting with such a huge scale of project has helped me in my own business. I can now look back and think, how did I do this? How did I do that? Who did I call? What contacts have I got? I learnt to rely on other people. I learnt to partner, and I learnt that I don't know everything. Some of the biggest lessons in life. And that's not to mention also that because of this, I got the Premier's Award from the South Australian Premier. I got to go to Government House. I got to meet the local representative of the Queen, the Governor General. I got to do all these other things, which have bettered my career, which were totally unexpected. But the real things I got out of the value are the lasting relationships with people I can call on when I'm in trouble, which again comes back to the whole community aspect.
I think that it's an interesting, you know, again, it's an interesting conversation because my experience of late has been that many people, not necessarily just in the IT field, are obviously, you know, time challenged and they have problems, you know, running their own business and getting the work done. However, it seems to me that people who volunteer and people who go out of their way seem to be able to find the time to do that plus do other things. I think that, again, it's a matter of people tend to look perhaps at only the short-term gain, and maybe it's a bit selfish saying, well, what do I get out of it? I think that, again, the idea is if you go into it with no preconception and, like I said, you give of yourself and you get personal fulfillment, then the returns flow from that, but also there are additional flows down the track. And I think one of the things that I find in business today that's most important is the old adage that it's, not what you know, it's who you know. The Google and the search engines have commoditized knowledge to an extent, and all these people blogging. So again, it's very important, or it's very handy to be able to know an expert in the field and be able to call on them and get them to be able to assist you. So those sort of relationships don't just spring up overnight. They are something that you need to build and need to encourage. And like I said, volunteering and getting involved with the community is a great way of building that up. And perhaps there's not an immediate tangible return on that investment, but as you're saying, I believe is that in the long run, you get, all the benefits plus more, I think is what you're saying.
Absolutely, you do. Let me give you one example in my own business at the moment. We concentrate on putting out small business servers and working with small businesses. Now, some of the things that are occurring at the moment is there's new packages of software coming out that we're installing to our servers, which are causing some problems. I've been trawling through TechNet to see if anybody else out there in the forums is having similar problems. Now, I'm getting the benefit of reading other people's solutions. I'm getting the benefit of them having already struck up the conversation with other MVPs and with Microsoft and things like that, and seeing what the things are that they've tried. I can then come back and try those things with my clients, and quite often the solutions are right spot on. They work, they get me to the answer quicker. So I've learned quite a bit from trawling the forums. But while I'm there, I answer a few questions as well. Now I'm building my rapport out there. People are starting to know that this person out there who's answering questions may know what he's talking about, and at the same time, stumbling over the answers to what are my own problems. So, yes, you have to find time to go out there and answer some questions and do things like that. But while you're out there, you're possibly saving time because you're finding answers to problems you've been having for the last 2 weeks or the last few, 3 months in some of the cases, which is saving your staff time, saving you time, helping you get a better solution out to your customers to the point where that service finished, I can now move on to the next one. That's got a huge business benefit. That's got a good personal benefit. And as well as that, you're benefiting others because while you're in the forums, you're giving feedback, you're pointing people to knowledge base articles you know about and that kind of thing. It takes very little time to find an answer in Google, paste it in there, and then quite often you come back after a single line entry. Maybe you've just put in one KB article link and the person says, thank you so much. I've been looking for that. I have not been able to find it. This is fantastic. Thank you.
I think the other thing too is what I would say is that, it's, the first point of call generally for most issues is, throw it into the search engine, and, most people throw in something and get, a couple of billion results back, and then having to trawl through it and what's right, what's wrong, what's a, reliable source of information. I think that, part of the community or building up is knowing where to look. So, the Microsoft forum, the partner supported forums are a good example. Key people, MVPs or whatever, who write the blogs, who, put information up there. Again, I think it's the successful, especially in the technology field, the successful technology specialist these days has a range of resources they can call on rather than just doing a blind search. So they may check, with the contacts they know, the specialist in the product, they may then go to a forum and post a question, or they may follow or post a comment on somebody's blog. So again, I think part of that is that in our time poor environment, you can spend a lot of time spinning your wheels looking for a result, going through it the hard way, or again coming back to that statement of it's who you know. That who you know can save you a huge amount of time and effort and heartache to get to a solution that you need for your customers.
Absolutely. I can think of a time I was in New Zealand doing a presentation for Microsoft, and I remember being online before the presentation, just following up a video. My main reason for the actual presentation was to talk about Small Business Survey 2003 and mobility and remote access and things like that. The video I was actually watching was another MVP, Wayne Small and Jeff Middleton, talking about a problem that had occurred and how they had to network together to get this problem fixed. And it was a great scenario for me to put forward for SBS 2003 and remote access. What had actually happened, and I can't remember which one of the two it was, but one of them was on a cruise. He was on a boat in the middle of the ocean, and one of his clients had a problem with his server. And what this person did is they went in and used the satellite uplink from this particular boat to remote across to the other MVP's server, who gave him remote desktop access, who then used that to bounce through to another server, and four servers later was able to bounce halfway around the globe to this particular server that was in trouble and fix the client's problem. There's a classic example of someone who's on holiday, who's well and truly beyond the normal realm of access, and yet they were able to use their network of friends and network of resources to get the job done. Guarantee you, when that person stepped off the boat, off of holidays, back into work, there was probably a box of chocolates waiting for him. Everyone appreciates when you put that little bit extra in, take that little bit extra time, especially when they know you're not actually available. Now, the network here went through two MVPs, all their servers, and their relationships with other people to get this person halfway around the globe to fix the problem. And that's typical of what MVPs do. We network together, we share resources, and we've also got lots of user group members out there that are not MVPs, but they're willing to muck in and help out. We can quite often make an impact through the network of people we know.
I think the other thing too, the caveat that I'd put on that is that, yeah, look, there's a lot of people out there and I agree and whatever, but I would also suggest that, you know, there needs to be a relationship building. You can't be on the peripheral and sort of, you know, hedging your bets, and then when you need somebody's assistance desperately, you know, call them and expect them to jump to straight away. I mean, they probably will. That's fantastic, and you know, obviously do need to say thank you. But what I'd be encouraging people, what I believe works best, is you need to be building these relationships on an ongoing basis. You know, so you know, after your Jamboree experience is completed, I would assume that, you know, you didn't go dark, you didn't go silent, you kept in touch with these people as best you could, you know, involve them in other projects, see how they're going. Again, you kept this relationship going. So one of the best examples I've heard is that, you know, when you start up or meet somebody for the first time, it's like opening a joint bank account. You know, you both start putting deposits in and building up this relationship with each other and doing favors and all that sort of stuff. You basically can't open a bank account and then start withdrawing significant amounts immediately. So, look, there are plenty of people out there who help and all that sort of stuff. But again, I think that in this day and age, to really get the best leverage, it's part of, you know, growing the relationship. It's more than technology. It's you know, to some extent, you know, a lot of people can do technology and a lot of people do technology these days, but how many of them are really good, you know, do have really good support networks? And it's not difficult for you to arrange, not difficult for you to build, just a little bit of your time to build these relationships. I mean, would you agree with that's, you know, more and more important these days?
Absolutely. Look, when we broke up AJ 2004, we had the biggest party ever. There were, 12,000-13,000 people on site. People leaving in buses, and it was a bit of a sad event, but we kept it going afterwards. We opened up a Facebook page where we've got all of the IT&T team on there posting their favourite photos from the event, as well as that, any new projects they're involved in. We just discuss it on there. We give each other hints and tips. We keep in touch. And the thing about the way we work these days is that the things like Facebook and other cloud applications can keep us all talking very closely while we're scattered across the globe. Because one of the things that happened after AJ 2004 for us is some of the guys actually shifted into state. And the way we kept in touch, of course, is through the internet. You're almost sitting beside them in the same room and you can keep quite in touch. But the other thing this has done is it's got me involved in other projects as well. One of the most unexpected projects ever actually led to me being behind the camera that was involved in filming the Star Wars Phantom Menace episode. Film. It's actually, I think it was a $300,000 camera, and to rent it per day was $30,000, and that included the camera and the lighting and the person to run it. And that was involved in a little South Australian community film. The reason I got involved is I supplied all the gadgets that they used in the film, like the photocopier, the printer, and the computers. So I was this IT geek who came along, donated some components into the film that I could use as props, And they've turned around to me and said, hey, how would you like to be the executive producer? Suddenly, I'm sitting there with a clapboard, counting down scenes, working as part of this film. Something not to do with IT, something that has expanded my horizons, all because one of the other guys in that film crew happened to be involved in AJ 2004. So I'm actually seeing things from just different perspectives, getting involved in other aspects of other things that aren't even related to IT, which has kept me in some ways well grounded, but it's also meant I've got to dabble and experiment and play and do things I never thought were possible. Whoever thought I'd be holding that camera?
I think the other thing too is that as the industry changes, technology is becoming commoditized, it's becoming more accepted, it's becoming more prevalent. Again, there is this opportunity, as you talk about, is to expand into other areas, is to take on other passions, is to be involved in, you know, specific areas of technology rather than maybe just the mundane break fix or, you know, copier repair or, you know, standard sort of stuff that IT people do. But again, like I said, it comes back to the old statement. It's who you know. It's building these relationships so that when the opportunity comes, you are the best placed, or you are the one that's well known, or you are the one who's more likely to get it. I think that one of the mistakes or one of the oversights I made when I first started out was that my belief was that as a technical person, I was the best technical person in the world and bar none. And again, you know, I didn't need anybody else's help. I knew it all. I could work it all out, blah, blah, blah. But you learn very soon that there's just no way you can cover it all. And again, the smart people basically, you know, work with other smarter people and help them and then receive help in return. So I think, like you say, the big takeaway from that is that, you know, again, you build these relationships, you build this network of people which you may never have had an opportunity to exist in before. And as you noted, part of it was that you pushed yourself beyond the boundary or beyond where it was comfortable into this new venture, this new area, and all these benefits did flow from that. So, I mean, that's a great example.
Yeah, look, that's right. Try and push yourself into new challenges, into new things. One of the things I learned early on is you can't be the master of everything. You're the same as me. I tried the same thing. I tried to take it all on. To be honest, it just leads to having a panic attack one day when you realize you just can't cope. You can't know how to program a Cisco router and also know how to program a Sonic Wall router and how to install server and how DNS works and how MX and DNS works and how everything else behind the scenes works. That's why these larger corporations have, you know, Active Directory experts and DNS experts and workstation experts. They segmentize it so that they all work together as a team, that no one person has to know everything. It's not a case of you're not smarter because you can't know everything. It's a case of you are smarter because you know your part of the product 100% as best as you ever could and can work with others. You're also more useful that way.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, that's exactly the point. And, you know, as the technology gets broader and there's so many more, it's a benefit to, you know, find these experts, network these experts, buddy up with them and you know, get involved with them and let them know that, like I said, you know, if they need help in something, again, it's a matter of being, you know, more specialised rather than trying to be too broad these days. So, look, you know, I think that's great advice. So one of the other things I'd like to cover in the time that we've got, Michael, is one of the other things that you are heavily involved with and have been for a while is Gitka. So probably the place to start with there is first let people know exactly what Gitka is and what function it is and what your role is in that organisation.
Sure. Look, Gitka is a completely volunteer organisation. The structure involves commitments from volunteers for a certain amount of time per month. It's quite a heavy involvement. And we're basically an interface into Microsoft for user groups. Now, Gitka is the Global IT Community Association, exactly as per the name. It's global, it's all about IT, and it's got community in it. It doesn't concentrate on any one particular technology. At the moment, it's very Microsoft-centric, but that's just because of the way it's played out. We also have links to Intel and Cisco and other products as well. Gitka has millions of members worldwide. I haven't seen the latest figures, but there's a humongous amount of people involved. User groups subscribe to the Gitka system to get access into support services from Microsoft. Now, traditionally, Microsoft haven't had an internal arm who can interface with millions of different user group leaders and users and things like that. So what they've needed is they've needed somebody to sit there between them and those groups. They have had iNeta for some time with developers and they've had PaaS and now Pika for the different technology type subjects for people who are either developers or IT pro to then come to Microsoft and say, hey, look, I'm doing a presentation next month. I need to find a room. I need to be able to pay for that room. I need to be able to provide some giveaways, some pizza, maybe a projector and a speaker. There needs to be a way for Microsoft to be able to say, you know, we've actually got someone on staff who knows that topic. They'd love to speak. How about we can get them involved and make them talk with this group and go out and do the presentation. And while they're there, they can bring with them some prizes and giveaways and organize everything. So we're a bit of an enabler and an interface. We give people access into Microsoft. We're one organization that talks to Microsoft, whereas millions talk to us. Some of the examples I've heard, there's a user group in Korea who are so large that if they have everybody attend their meetings, they need to hire the local baseball field. I think it was 18,000 members or something. Something that just scares me, scares the living daylights out of me. How do you talk to 80,000 people? That is a lot. And we have a lot of groups like that. Thankfully, I myself am not presenting in front of that number. But I myself do also get around and see a lot of the groups here in Australia and throughout Asia Pacific. We have members scattered out throughout China, through India, Japan, New Zealand, and myself in Australia in Asia Pacific. And in just our small circle alone, we have millions and millions of user groups we look after.
Okay. So, I mean, what's your take, what's your feel, given your, you know, the global overview you have of user groups and technology groups, you know, what's your sort of feeling of the future of these groups? You know, I mean, I'm involved in one locally, and you know, there are challenges running it and getting members and getting them involved and giving them stuff that interests them and grow it and improve the demographics and so on. I mean, you know, what's your take on the direction of the community or these sort of groups going forward? Do you see it as being a positive situation? Do you think we're going to grow, or do you think we're going to face challenges, or that's morphing, or what do you think?
I think we are in a stage of morphing at the moment. I think user groups are changing and shrinking. Now, I don't know whether it's because people are getting more and more time poor. I don't know if people think they've learned everything. I don't know. I've been to so many user groups where you've got a plan for the whole meeting structured. You've got worked out what presentation you're going to give. And then one person at the beginning of the meeting stands up, asks one question, and derails the whole meeting because that one question has such an interesting answer, so much better than the presentation, and people go home having learned something. But the problem is getting the people to these meetings so they can hear these things going on, so they can learn these things to help grow the groups. Because at the moment, I'm noticing out throughout, especially in China and India, the groups are rapidly expanding and there's new groups coming up every week. Throughout New Zealand and Australia, groups are disappearing. I don't know what has to be done to excite people into these groups, because I think we're battling with home life, with lack of time, people preoccupied with other things, and maybe got kids, I don't know. But the exciting thing for me is that once you can get people into groups and those people know other people, again, it comes back to networks, you can grow your groups. I believe the only way to make a group sustainable and to grow is the networking component that happens outside of the group time. So sure, you might meet for 1 or 2 or 3 hours a month, but that meeting time, that's just your face time when you're physically there in the room listening about a particular topic. You need to have little social groups so that after that, you can actually discuss what you've seen, digest it, talk with others, get them involved and do your networking. Only way I can see groups growing is networking. Some groups are very closed. Some groups, you have to pay your fee. You have to have your name on a list before you can actually start socializing and talking outside of the group. Whereas the groups I see that are growing are those that, yes, you have fees involved, and yes, there are a list of members, but the group's quite open to discussing with groups external and people external and inviting them in, thereby growing their actual base. So at the moment, I don't really have an answer for you because things are moving in such different ways in different areas. we're also having struggles in different areas, things that you've probably never thought of. For instance, in China, I can't actually send them to a Facebook page. I can't send them to a Twitter page. If I send them an email and I have a Twitter link or a Facebook link in my email signature, they don't get my whole email. So just recently, Gitka, we had the 24 hours in a private cloud where we worked with Microsoft and Dell and a couple of other vendors to invite everybody in our groups globally for 24 hours to log into a virtual presentation that allowed people to online chat, download PDFs, PowerPoint presentations, listen to the person from Dell, listen to the person from Gitka, and all that kind of thing. Every invitation to that event that I sent to China did not get delivered. Every single link I sent to China didn't get through. Then we've also got problems in Japan. When the earthquakes went through, the nuclear events went through, a lot of groups got disbanded everywhere. Their internet got disrupted. They were no longer in contact. Similar thing happened in Christchurch. We had about 10 groups that just disappeared off the face of the map in Christchurch. I don't believe anybody was actually injured or anything in the actual earthquake, but because they lost their offices that they normally had the events in, because all their internet got disrupted and all that kind of thing, it just all fell apart. So we've got different problems in different geographical areas. The China is best served by people in China. I can't speak Chinese, and a number of the emails I've got that are written in Chinese, I can't read them. So one of the members, one of the volunteers, I should say, that's in my group, in my team, is from China, and he's heading that up for me. And everything that he tells me about what's going in China is completely different to Australia. The thing about Australia that a lot of people don't understand that they live in Australia is, yes, we are a very big country. In fact, if you overlay Australia with the US, forget in Canada and Mexico, we're about the same size, the land mass. But the problem is we don't have as many people as in America, as an example, and the gap between the masses of people, we have a lot of travelling distance, which is something fairly unique to Australia. So you can't say to people that, okay, we can get presenters from a local area who you've not seen before, who's fresh and got talent that we can bring in, because it involves flying, it involves booking hotels, it involves a lot of mucking around. So with Australia, getting resources to user groups is actually a bigger challenge than places like India, where there are a lot of people in a very small space and everybody's learning about IT and everyone's a specialist in a particular product. In India, there is no shortage of presenters. There's no shortage of people wanting to attend to groups. And we're seeing a whole heap of new groups start every month, from student organisations through to business affiliates, all kinds of little groups being created. Australia seems to be falling a little behind. And I do think it is geographical. I do think it's because we're time poor. I do think it's the way our culture is working. So at the moment, we're in this flux where I don't quite know where we're going to be in 12 months' time. I think that I've seen some very successful groups that are expanding, but they are the ones that are really hammering home the networking aspects. They're creating Facebook pages. They're inviting their members to invite other people to the Facebook pages. They're doing newsletters to not only the members, but other people beyond. They're having almost what you would call an open day, where they're inviting non-members in for big presentations. And it might be a carrot, there might be a hot lab, or there might be a giveaway or something like that, but they're going out and beyond their normal membership lists, because the membership lists are just that, they're a list. They're not actually the number of people or the people who will actually attend your meeting. They're just people who have paid the fee or they've signed up or they've linked up with you. You might have 200 people on the list and 10 turn up. You need to make that 10 into 20 or 30. You need to network, get people excited, find a time that people are available and get them into the user groups. That's the challenge at the moment.
So here's another angle on this. What's your feeling about, you know, webcasting, remote access to meetings and that sort of thing? I mean, obviously we've tried something similar in a number of different ways within our little local user group. And you know, everybody says, yeah, we want it, we want it, we want it, we want it. But at the end of the day, the results seem to indicate that not very many people participate online and not many people, you know, download the recording afterwards, whether they're time poor or whatever. I mean, again, it seems to me a case that, you know, a great idea and concept and, you know, webcasting and the technology's there and blah, 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 but when it actually comes to it, nobody actually, you know, within the community seems to really take it up and run with it. I mean, is that something that you see might overcome our issues with distance, or is that again something that's, you know, the culture's, you know, making it even just as tough as well as attending in person?
Look, I think that's very much an Australian thing, to be honest. Let me start with this. I think it was earlier last week, there was a opening of a building, and a politician would be opening a building, and it was the first virtual opening that has ever been held. So basically they had a big TV set up, they had the crowd amassing for this opening. Now, the crowd wasn't as big as they thought it was going to be, and they sort of diagnosed it afterwards why they had this huge big politician, you know, very famous, opening this building, but no one wanted to see it actually happen. A lot of the people said that's because having the human being there, having the politician actually there, means I can say I was in the same room as this person. I was actually able to see this person. I was able to walk up, shake their hands, get an autograph, whatever they want to do. Whereas having them on a webcast makes me think, okay, they're squeezing me in a time frame they've got available, because they've got other important things they're doing either side and they can't make the time to turn up. Now, from one aspect, I'm thinking this is fantastic. It's a virtual opening. They're making it available to not only people in this time zone, but from anywhere in Australia. People can just take a lunch break, sit back and watch it, then get back to work. Isn't that fantastic? I never thought about that other aspect. This person is famous enough that the draw card is the person. If the person's not there, the people who are actually watching that virtual meeting and the people who are turning up to that virtual meeting, they're not actually interested. That's one aspect. But look, the other thing I've noticed is China, Japan, and India are doing a lot of webcasts. In fact, they are doing streaming and all the rest of it from almost every single meeting, and they are seeing double and tripling of the people watching those webcasts in the first 6 or 7 months. They are getting huge numbers along. In Australia, you're quite right. Everyone I've spoken to, the numbers are dwindling off. I don't quite know what's happening in Australia and why it's so different. I know that, for instance, talking to my counterpart in Japan, that they have a longer, harder work day than us. They are more time poor than us. They have to travel longer distances on public transport for longer periods of time than us, and yet they make time to do these webcasts. They take time to attend these webcasts. Whereas in Australia, I really don't know why, but we're going backwards. I can't answer that for you.
Okay, so we might, obviously our time's, you know, our time's drawing close to an end here, and I'll finish off with getting your feedback on this. One of the concepts that was brought to me recently by someone outside the industry is they've noted that a big trend now is this virtual conference. So because of the GFC and the cutback in corporate travel in places like the US and Europe, what all the conferences and events did is they ran virtual events. So you can still attend in person, but now they're able to broadcast the event and you know, with the internet links and webcasts, and they found it to be very, you know, very, very successful. So there's that aspect. But I noticed that there are a lot of events, and I do run my own events, and I must admit that I've been very disappointed in a lot of them. That, you know, there seems to be, we want training, we want this, we want to, but again, actually getting bums on seats or getting people to meet face to face is a great challenge. And it, again, it seems to me as though that here most of the people are coming for just pure technical. If the pure technical doesn't tickle their fancy or it doesn't fill an exact technical need, they won't attend. They won't look at it in a broader sense. They won't look at it in a business networking. They won't look at it in a, you know, getting involved with their peers and catching up and, you know, potentially, you know, volunteering some of their time. You know, what's your feeling or what's your observation about, you know, these sort of industry events that we used to have? So many years ago, I remember that Microsoft used to run a roadshow and a partner roadshow, and it was once every quarter, and, you know, all the guys got together and we, you know, chatted over and you know, enjoyed the day and got some technology feel. Microsoft obviously doesn't run those anymore for a reason. It seems to me that this is a bit of a dying, a dying situation, and I think that's bad for the industry, because, again, a lot of people in the industry aren't using the Facebook, aren't using Twitter, aren't using social networking. So again, it's becoming a bit of an isolated community that it's not able to integrate well with the rest of society and find out what's going on and where the technology needs are. I mean, early days, but again, it seems to me as though Like I said, you know, the IT people used to be some of the most community-minded people that you would find out there. But now that seems to be, like I said, falling away. I mean, have you got any experience, comment? Is there any, you know, suggestions that you might have to for groups out there or people who are wanting to get involved? I mean, what would your suggestions be?
Well, first of all, looking at those events and things like that, I agree. There's been a number of events by vendors where the wholesalers used to go around state by state. They used to have little hors d'oeuvres and people serving them. You used to be able to walk up and talk to somebody and I guess basically chew the fat, as they say, talk about the products, get brochures and walk away and feel like you've achieved something, you've made a contact. Since they've gone virtual, these trade events have had dropping numbers, and I'm guilty of that. I used to go to every single event for one particular wholesaler, and since they've gone virtual, I've not even bothered. And I think it's because that particular event is recorded and it's available at any time. I've always got in the back of my mind, oh, I can always do it next week. Oh, I can always do it the week after. Rather than, oh no, I've got to be somewhere at 6 p.m. I've got to be there for the start of this event, because if I miss it, they're moving to Perth tomorrow. I think there's a lot of this urgency business that's not there with the recorded events. There's always this thought in your mind, I can always look at that later. It's available for download. I'll get to it when I've got time, but you never make the time. I think having somebody actually allocated a time when they have to be somewhere and have to be meeting with somebody is the only way to keep those sorts of events alive. I can certainly understand why a particular Microsoft have backed off the live partner roadshows and things like that, but that was some of the best events out there. The drinks afterwards with the presenters, the meetings beforehand, the networking event at the beginning, and just being in an atmosphere. It's the same as going to a movie. You go to a movie, and if everybody watching that movie laughs and enjoys the movie, you enjoy the movie more. If you hire the same movie on DVD and take it home, it's just you in the room watching it, when the moments come to laugh, you may not laugh because people around you aren't laughing. You haven't got the atmosphere. And I think that's what's missing, is the atmosphere from those sorts of events, which is why the virtual events are starting to die off. They don't have the same impact. And a lot of people use those events to catch up with other people and network. If they don't have those times to network, then there's no reason to be at the events. So that's with the virtual stuff. My personal feeling is it's the networking component that's missing. With the future community and all the rest of it, the volunteering, I'm thinking from what I've seen in the last 20 years, that the major component in that is networking, getting people out there to start shaking hands, talking to each other, sharing experiences, talking about things other than IT, just to bond, just to get to know people. That would also help with numbers for user groups. It would also help get young blood in to help us out, because some of us guys have been doing it for a while now. We're starting to sit back and slow down. We need new people in. We need new volunteers in, community-minded people in to start doing things. Only way to do that is network with them, show them what we've learned, show them what you can achieve, and get them excited about it. That's the thing I've got to put out to your listeners, is how do we make you, the listener, excited about this stuff? How do we get you guys into the community, out there talking, because you will benefit. Don't go into it with the aim of benefiting, but I guarantee you, in some way, you will benefit. And those around you will benefit. Your circle of friends will expand. You will have people you can rely on. You will have people who can help you when you've got a problem. So really, how do we do that for you out there? And get curious. That's what we're about. We're trying to get people excited about getting out there, starting user groups, trying to bring members along to user groups, not only the interface of Microsoft. As I said, GitKur, we're a bit agnostic. We deal with Intel and other people. But just get people in technology involved and networking and starting that conversation.
Okay, so look, I think that obviously we've run out of time, and obviously there's a lot more that we could chat about. And I think that's you know, that's been a great summary that you've given us there, Michael. And we do take the time to thank you very much for sharing part of your day and sharing your thoughts with us today. Just to finish off, can you let people know how to get in contact with you or follow you or basically network with you? What's the best way for them to follow up with you if they'd like to?
Certainly. Look, if you want to follow up on the GitCare aspect of it, we have a GitCare Facebook page and also an APAC GitCare page. We also have a GitCare and an APAC underscore GitCare Twitter account, which you can look at. And from the GitCare website, www.gitcare.org, My email address should be up there as well, which is quite simply michael.jenkin@gitcurt.org, and we can start the conversation from there. Now, that address is usually for Gitcurt Matters, but look, if you've got any community questions, any volunteering questions, even if it's a project not to do with anything to do with the IT user group as such, but it's involved with IT, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to give you feedback, because my role in Gitcurt is all about volunteering, community, and making it all work. I honestly don't care if it's not to do with Gitcurt. It's all about getting you guys interested in getting out there.
I think that's great, and I certainly hope that people take that opportunity to connect with Michael and you know all the other things that he does, and to take away from this the fact that there are plenty of people out there who are more than willing to help, that are you know looking to get involved and be community minded. But again, you know, it's a give and a take. You know, we would like to see a bit more involvement, people stepping up to the mark, getting involved, you know, going outside their standard level of comfort, and perhaps you know what they do day to day, asking questions and helping out. And I think that certainly improves not only the individual but also the group, and at the end of the day it improves what we can deliver to customers. So I think there's been a huge amount of benefit, there's been a huge amount of takeaways here for anybody who's been listening, and certainly it'll go up on the website for all to hear and download over time. So once again, Michael, I thank you very much for the time that you've given us today and all the information and all the experience that you've provided, and I'm sure that a lot of people will get a huge amount of benefit out of that.
Thank you, Robert, for taking the time to listen to a little bit about the community side and the volunteering side. Thank you very much for bringing that to light, and hopefully this is useful to those out there.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure it will, and we need to get on with the rest of our day and hopefully generate some more revenue, keep our businesses going. I'd like to take this opportunity again to thank Michael, to thank our audience for listening, and look forward to their participation. And once again, thank you very much for listening to another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.